Welcome to Survival Mode Disrupted, the podcast for those who are done performing, done people pleasing, and done living life on autopilot. I'm your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and this is where we create disruptive, unapologetic transformations for those who are ready to exit survival mode and reclaim their power. Every episode is your permission slip to burn the rule book, break the cycle, and finally build a life that feels like yours. So let's disrupt everything that's holding you back and start living life on your own terms. This is your trigger warning. This podcast is raw. It is real, and it doesn't sugarcoat what it means to survive trauma, abuse, mental health battles, or even the aftermath of living in survival mode for too damn long. What you hear on Survival Mode Disrupted includes unfiltered stories, graphic details, and a vulnerable truth that may trigger some of the audience. Please prioritize your emotional safety. If something feels too heavy, pause. Breathe. Come back when you're ready or not at all. Your healing is yours to honor. These episodes are based on lived experience, not therapy sessions or clinical advice. Listening does not replace mental health treatment or constitute a coach-client relationship. If you're in crisis, please seek immediate help from a licensed professional or contact your local emergency services. This space is built with care, but it's also built for truth and built for disruption. Take what you need, leave the rest, and most of all, trust yourself. If this podcast speaks to your soul, you don't have to do this work alone. Feel free to join our free Facebook community for high-achieving women ready to break cycles and heal out loud. Join us at Disrupting Survival Mode on Facebook, or grab the book that started this movement, Exiting Survival Mode, a raw step-by-step guide to help you identify, release, and rebuild from the survival patterns that have been keeping you stuck. Hello, 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 and welcome back to another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted. I am your host, Leticia, the Survival Mode Disruptor, and today we have George. So, George, why don't you introduce yourself?
Well, my name is George P. Brooks. I'm originally from Memphis, Tennessee. Was diagnosed with bipolar disorder, age 7. Grew up dealing with that, severe emotional trauma, a 10-year cocaine addiction, homelessness, and all of that to have started my nonprofit Meta Association about 7 years ago, where we focus on Black mental health. We focus on fighting recidivism, promoting fatherhood, and healing in our community.
That's powerful stuff, George. So let's get started. How would you describe survival mode?
I think survival mode to me represents a defense mechanism. It's a state of mind that I feel like the mind enters into when its resources are tapped, whether they be physical or emotional. Survival mode can be physical or emotional or mental, sometimes even spiritual. It's the just state that you enter into where you're just operating on the bare minimum just to get by, just to see the next day. And the thing about survival mode, while it's valuable, that's really a catalyst for you to start healing. So survival mode serves a lot of purposes. Not only does it keep us going for a little while, it's a prompt for us to take action and try to get better.
I love that because a lot of people don't necessarily see the benefits in being in survival mode, but I agree with you that it serves an important benefit. What is important to remember, though, is survival is not the final destination. Thriving is. So, George, tell us your story to and through survival mode.
Wow. Well, like I said, originally from Memphis, Tennessee, was diagnosed with bipolar age 7, went through the emotional trauma coming up, really an education system that failed me and continues to fail those living with disabilities and mental illnesses. You know, I grew up, I did the typical thing, went to college, got married, bought a house at 23. But I was not dealing with my mental illness. I was not dealing with my trauma. I was not dealing with myself. So I fell into about a decade-long depression where I succumbed to the temptation of cocaine. In 2018, things started to happen. And I had to make a choice whether I was going to lay down and be, you know, resolute in the matter or do something about it. So I got up. I was inspired to start a nonprofit to heal myself, to address my mental health more vigilantly, which has been a great improvement, and to beat the addiction and truly overcome it in a way that's substantive and permanent.
I've had two intimate relationships with addicts, and understanding what that what addiction looks like, that compulsive desire to get high, has always interested me. I am the type of person that kind of always wonders the why behind actions, right? I'm not sure what your drug of choice was, but could you talk a little bit about the insanity involved with addiction? Because I find that a lot of people, unless it hits their doorstep, they don't have a desire to understand. So I think this, if you don't mind, just sharing what that journey looks like or looked like for you.
Every time, and my drug of choice was cocaine. Every time you use a drug, what you're doing, you're trying to mask some sort of hurt, some sort of unresolved trauma. The drug has become a choice and a crutch for you because you have unresolved trauma you're not dealing with. I don't know of any addicts to ever use because it was just fun to them. When you peel back the layers of what was going on with them and look at the real root of addiction, it's because of things that happened in your childhood. It's because of things you experience, and that escapism becomes alluring because here's the thing, especially if you have people in your life that are not supportive, because the drug didn't judge you. The drug is not going to ridicule you. As long as you get that drug, it'll be there. That's your security blanket. So the key to beating addiction, and I will say this to my last breath, is dealing with the underlying trauma. Then you can start to kind of work on the addiction. Once I've started dealing with my underlying trauma and taking accountability for my life being the way it was, that's another key thing in recovery is accountability. Kicking the drugs, well, I'm not going to say it was easy, but it stuck. The last day I used was the last day I used. I hadn't touched it since then because I'm past that point. One thing, though, that's a point of frustration for a lot of addicts, too, is when we do overcome addiction, we have people that are always in the back of their minds thinking we're using again. And that does get to be frustrating because it's like that's the furthest thing from me. And it can really, I'm not saying it's going to cause someone to relapse, but it can impede their progress. So people, especially if you don't really understand addiction, and you know someone that's beat it, try not to be so, oh God, every 5 seconds they're using again, because it's frustrating, you know? And it's something that makes recovery a little bit harder.
I think you raise an important point, and that boils down to having compassion, I think. There is a lack of compassion in the world across the board, particularly when there is an opportunity to pass blame. Okay, yeah. Well, he's an addict, so... Yeah. Whatever. You know what
this
I mean?
World, this world has a problem with accountability.
Yes.
With people, I mean, and that means just even me looking in the mirror. Because like when my marriage broke up, you know, I had to go in the bathroom and look in the mirror and be like, you know what? I'm responsible for this part of it. I'm responsible for this part of it. I had to do that. Mm-hmm. And right now in society, we're taught to not take accountability. Everything is someone else's fault. Even if we get offended about something, it's someone else's fault. So until we try to instill a culture of accountability, a lot of things that you know, plague society will persist.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you wholeheartedly. And I think a huge step in healing beyond our trauma is getting to a place where we can take ownership. Like, for instance, I got arrested on my corporate job, not because of anything I did. And that was the truth. My addict boyfriend at the time brought me into his chaos, and I was unaware of what was happening. And as I sat in that jail cell, I had to come to terms with the fact that although I was not primarily responsible for being in the jail that day. My decision led me to a place where I trusted this man when I knew I shouldn't have, right? Like, it wasn't my first time with an addict. It wasn't my first time being exposed to the manipulation that comes with that disease. But I chose to stay and I chose to trust when I knew that I couldn't. So I had to take ownership. I had to take accountability because had I not made that decision to show up at that day at that given time, I wouldn't have been there. I wouldn't have been in that situation where I got arrested. And oftentimes, it's so we learn to pass blame very early on. And I heard someone say, the biggest addiction is the wor in the world is blame. And when we sit back and look at it, I mean, I tend to, my opinion tends to differ slightly, but I do think blame is the core of a lot of the conflict that we see, a lot of the dis-ease that we see in the world, because people simply aren't taking accountability.
Well, the thing about that makes blame so attractive to people is that if you're able to blame someone else, that means you don't have to address the issue that's causing the problem in the first place. So once you take accountability, you then, in essence, make yourself responsible for facilitating that change that caused the action in the first place. So, if I can blame you, that means I don't have to deal with my issues. That means I don't really have to address it. It's your fault, so it's not on me. And that's something that's so easy to do because that's just what we've gotten used to. It permeates our society and our young people.
Absolutely. So when you recovered, were you part of a 12 a step process? I won't say 12, what a step process. What did your recovery look like? Was it just a decision and then consistent action? What did it look like?
Ooh, it looked like. And some of my memories on a lot of this stuff is hazy, but it looked like 30 days laying on my couch in my house alone, just going through it, laying there. I had the flu at the time, going through the withdrawals of cocaine addiction, just thinking about what I needed to do next. About a month later, I started getting up and doing those subtle things, the household routines, moving around, doing some work stuff. And I just had to build myself up from there. So it was a journey. And just last week I celebrated the 7 year anniversary of my nonprofit, and 7 is the number of completion. So I'm looking at from transitioning from that point onto a new journey now in my life. But there's 7 year, I look at it like 7 years of recovery. It was a long, slow process. It involved a lot of therapy, a lot of tears, a lot of ups and downs. But the thing is, recovery is a daily endeavor. It's not something you do for a week and you're good. No, there has to be a conscious effort to endeavor upon your recovery every day. So what it looks like is just daily rituals, staying focused, taking care of myself, doing the best I can to be the best person I can be, and addressing my trauma through therapy, through medication, through whatever it takes to not only just get past it, but try to heal from it to the point where it does not impede my function any further.
And I agree with you. Recovery, just like healing, is an everyday process. There isn't this destination where all of a sudden, we're healed. All of a sudden, we've recovered. No, it's a daily choice. And I think, and it's work. It's not getting up every day. It's relearning the things
It's
that we
relearning.
knew.
It's relearning how to live, because when you get deep into addiction, your whole way of life, from the way you eat, the way you think, the way you bathe, everything gets altered, and you're really having to relearn how to live again. And that's a big part of the process. And another part about addiction that people that don't experience won't understand is that you get addicted to the ritual of getting a drug. You get addicted to the ritual of making a call, waiting on the guy to show up, getting with your friends, going to this spot. All that becomes ritualistic, to where that leads into the addictive nature, compounded with the effects of the drug itself. That's what makes it so powerful.
You mentioned an important point that recovery really, really is impossible without unpacking the trauma underneath, right? And it recovery isn't a band-aid. It isn't, you can't just put a band-aid on it and just act like it didn't exist. You know, there are triggers, there are things that can easily cause a relapse if they aren't dealt with. And I've seen in my experience with both of the addicts that I was involved with, it was a lot of family issues, right? At the core of why they used. And that meant they had to rediscover relationships beyond, you know, beyond the trauma. They had to learn how to show up differently, often in the same spaces that triggered them to use. And like I, you know, I'm emphasizing this because I want the listeners to really understand it's not just about not using drugs again. It's really like a rebirth, very similar to the accident of survival mode, right? Like when I talk about accident survival mode, I say that there are three phases. The first one is awareness, self-awareness. The second one is reprogramming. The third one is reinvention. And I think that too applies to the recovery process. First of all, we can change what we cannot see. And what I've seen in the recovery process from someone standing on the sidelines and just observing is very much that awareness, right? Really uncovering the triggers, uncovering the things that will, first of all, create a relapse for you. But then that the next step is rewriting the narratives, changing the way that we think about the trauma, processing the trauma as well, so that those triggers are no longer as powerful. And again, they don't go away, but they're not as powerful. And then it's this reinvention, and you just spoke to that slightly about you have to relearn life,
Yeah,
you
it's
know.
like a rebirth. And but here's the thing too, a lot of people, in this case is a lot of people, while going through recovery successfully can be a rebirth, it also involves a death. It's the death of a lot of bad habits, a lot of old ways of thinking, a lot of old coping mechanisms. It also is the death of many relationships, because you will find that even though you're accountable and you can accept what you've done, there are going to be people in your life who are not. And you can't be responsible. I can go to you and say, I'm sorry for everything I did. That doesn't mean you have to accept my apology. So a lot of those relationships will fall off in that regard. You'll realize how many relationships were really codependent and it really fed your addiction. If you have a permissive mother and she might yell and scream, but she gives you $30 so you can go get high, there may be a relationship that you may inevitably lose because it's unhealthy. And it was work to your detriment. So you have to be ready when you go into recovery to realize everybody's not going to come with me. It might be your own child, it might be your own mother, but you have to be okay with that. Otherwise, those are going to be things that previously, gave you the trauma, and you can't still be around them. I had to move 500 miles away from home to really solidify my recovery. That's just what I had to do. So it really has to be every step, everything you have to do to make that happen, that has to be your sole focus.
I agree. Even with trauma, right? There is this saying, you cannot heal in the same environment that traumatized you.
No.
And oftentimes we just try to fit our healing into our lifestyle when actually our lifestyle has to change in order for us to heal. And a lot of
Right.
people struggle with that step. Like, why can't I keep doing the things that I've done all this time? Well, if you keep doing the things that you've already always done, nothing about your outcome will change.
No.
Yeah. So I'm also interested because now you have another layer to your story, the bipolar disorder. How has that impacted your recovery?
It's something I have to think of every day. I'm also an insulin dependent diabetic, so I have to manage that along with the bipolar. And the reason why I equate the two is because I look at my mental illness as a medical condition. It's something I have to take medicine for, something I have to go to therapy for, something I have to talk to my doctor about. I have to manage it. And even if you're taking very strict care of your bipolar disorder, you're still going to have manic phases. You're still going to have depressive phases. It's still going to happen. So trying to mesh that in with the day-to-day of everything I try to do and keep those healthy habits in place and keep those healthy relationships in place is a challenge. But it definitely impacted recovery because when you're adjusting from drugs or that culture, it plays with your mind. Even a person without a diagnosable condition, it will play with their mind. So when you have that underlying condition with it, you have to be extra careful and take extra care to make sure that you're okay.
Okay. And in managing that, what would you say has been like your biggest aha moment along the way that really helped cement your recovery and your management of your mental condition or your health condition?
When I really realized that no one's going to do it for you, that no one's going to make sure that you're bipolar, okay, is okay. No one's going to come behind you and make you, you know. So once I really learned I'm responsible for how I feel, and once I really decided to take control of what I could control as far as how I felt every day, I know if I don't take my meds, I'm not going to feel right. If I don't get my rest, I'm not going to feel right. Once I started to accountability, I took accountability for myself. So that was my aha moment.
When you say accountability all the time, you said it quite frequently, and I like using big terms. I call it radical ownership, right? Like just taking ownership, like being able to show up and just say, like, it this is my life. And I am responsible for it. That means that I have to show up and do the things that will get me to the place that I want and need to be. And we're not taught that. We're not taught accountability. We're not taught ownership. We're not taught any of that. And what does accountability look like for you? Like, if you had to describe it to someone who's really like, I really don't know how to take accountability for my stuff, because sometimes we're very manipulative in the accountability process without really knowing. What is the first step in
Well,
being able to be accountable?
a certain amount of humility comes before accountability. You have to be real with yourself and just be able to say, hey, you know what? When I yelled at my wife and I was wrong for that, I was on some BS. And, you know, you have to break it down on that level and just be able to be vulnerable with yourself to admit that you're not perfect. Because we love to cast blame and, you know, we do it with celebrity worship, but how many times do we point the finger at ourselves and say, you know what? I'm kind of screwed up in this regard. So that's a big part of accountability, and that's really the first step of healing is that accountability. But for me, it just looks like being totally transparent and honest about things. There are different layers to my story that we can't even touch here, but I've been transparent about it because I feel like that's the best way to help people. So people can hear my experiences and some of the things I've been through and be like, well, okay, it's not just me. And I feel like, especially when, and I know this feeling, I've been there, when you're in the depths of what you got going on, sometimes just knowing you're not the only one can help you keep your head above water because that's when we feel our most alone, our most beaten, our most defeated in those quiet moments.
I find that culture plays a huge role in our ability to be vulnerable. So I'm asking you, as a black man, how difficult was it for you to lower your walls and be vulnerable enough to take that accountability?
The funny thing, I think I have more walls up now than I did when I was going through things emotionally. But it was not hard for me. I'm a Pisces. I'm a left-handed Pisces. We're sappy and emotional anyway, so it wasn't that big of a transition over to me kind of being open and honest. But I realized the difficulty that many of my brothers have. And I spoke at a cigar event, and there's been a cigar bar about a month ago. And where we had men come around, I hosted and facilitated and moderated, and we just had those conversations. And one thing I said, some of you brothers will engage. Some of you will just sit there quietly, but I know you're all there. So it depends on their each man's comfort level as far as how he wants to emote, how he wants to express himself. But the key is to provide him a safe place where he can do that in a way that's befitting and proper to him.
Safe spaces are so important. I also believe that representation is very important, right? So, like a white man or a white woman saying that to a bunch of black men, it wouldn't have been received as well. So, I think that's why it's so important. I think When we talk about like self-actualization, you know, like it's something that for me have been drilled into me from my very first encounter with psychology, like this Maslow's pyramid and self-actualization, I think is getting to that point where you see beyond your healing. You see, like you've taken it, you've done the work, but it's more than just theory. It becomes a lifestyle for you, and then you're at this place where you're ready to reach the hand back and help others, right? And I think that is such an important step in society when people can reach their hand back and help, because I think oftentimes, as we said at the beginning, a lot of us suffer in silence so much that without someone who has been through what we've been through or been through where we are aspiring to be, it often makes it quite difficult, you know. So just my little two cents, but I think, you know, representation, and I salute you for the things that you do with Black men, because I feel like I, particularly in our culture, I'm not American, but I am Black, and I think it's very similar in the conditioning that we have. Like, as a Black woman, I was like, you never let anybody see you weak, boo. Like, never ever. Like, you don't break down. You are as solid as a rock until you close that door and you are by yourself. So, being conditioned like that, being raised like that, when it came to my healing process and being in spaces where I'm in community settings and having to lower my guard was very, very hard for me, you know? But I found with that representation, with see another sister in the room, I'm a little bit more open, less guarded here. Even if it benefits me to lower my guard, it's still, I need to
Difficult.
see someone who really sees me.
And we're just conditioned to be that way, you know. And it's just something we can recondition ourselves. This is the beautiful thing about neuroplasticity and the mind. You can change the way the brain operates. You can change the way chemicals are secreted. Just in, if you look at the brain of someone that's bipolar and not, it's going to be different. You can look at the brain of someone that's in addiction and not, it's going to look different. So that's the thing. Not only can we change the neurochemistry of our brains through our actions, we can change our lives through our actions as well. You know, we have to change that way of thinking of that we're always the only ones. We can learn to be vulnerable in safe spaces to where we can catch people before they crack. Because especially with Black men, we usually don't catch them until they've already done something, until it's already too late. Well, if we can provide more vulnerable, safe spaces, more sanctuaries, and be a harbinger for them, mentally and emotionally, we can catch it before they crack. We can prevent all the things that come with a man breaking. We can do a lot more, but that's one of the things I've dedicated my life to, is trying to do that.
And I agree with you, right? And I think a lot of that conditioning starts at home, giving boys the space to process their emotions in wholeness, you know, like that's so key. Even if it's 90 seconds, give them the space to be human, because we
And I'm glad
all
you said
have
that.
emotions.
And I'm glad you said that, because a lot of my advocacy work, when I talk to guys and from my own personal experience as far as who I am, a lot of times we just need a minute. Just give us 15 minutes when things get heated, or, you know, especially if in a domestic situation, you know, you want to talk about the bills or whatever, just give them 15 minutes. What that allows, just allows a cool down moment, a time to sit, breathe, rest, collect your thoughts, figure out how to respond. Because if you're not responding, and I teach men this, if you're not responding, you're doing it wrong. That means you're reacting. You never want to react, you always want to respond. So that little breathing room, and it's for women too. Take a little breathing room. Give a chance a second to settle, collect your thoughts, and figure out how to respond instead of reacting.
That was huge for me. I experienced a lot of abuse from young. I was in an abusive relationship from the age of 14, and I was reactive. highly reactive. Like you, it got to a point you couldn't say anything to me. You know what I mean? And it wasn't that I wanted to be like that, but I have been in environments where I had to react. I literally had to in order to save my life. But doing it for so long, it became a way of life, when it didn't need to be. It didn't need to, I didn't need, but again, it was, I had to learn safety. I got addicted to the chaos. I didn't know what it was to be in peace. Like, I had a moment of peace, and what the hell's happening here?
Well,
Like, I'm bored, you know?
we get so used to being at war that it's hard for us to come home and take that armor off. And it has to come off piece by piece. And as it comes off piece by piece and we realize the war is over, we can settle the chaos in our minds and kind of relax. But that in itself is part of the healing process. And that's a journey, and it feels weird. It feels weird to wake up one day and realize my life ain't just going to crap right now. I'm okay right now. Even now, I struggle with it. It's like, I'm okay. So, you can get so used to the chaos and so used to the noise that you have to get used to peace sometimes.
Yeah, and that's a big one. Because it's like, even for me, I had 20 years of chaos, and when I finally found peace, I was just like, I don't even know what to do with this. I don't know how to process it.
It's a little scary. It's a little
Yeah.
scary because in the back of your mind, sometimes we tend to catastrophize and we think, well, this is nice, but it won't last long. And you have to ride that phase of the healing process out. But once you learn that you have the skills to manage any bumps in the road, you kind of enjoy your peace.
You prioritize it as well, right? Like,
That's right.
you're disturbing my peace, yo. George, I've enjoyed this conversation. So tell us how we can find you online and a little bit more about what you do in your nonprofit.
Okay, well, like I said, we focus on Black male mental health. We've helped people all over the world, so we help anyone. But we focus on Black male mental health just because we're a marginalized community, and I feel like we need the help the most. We promote healthy fatherhood, healthy relationships, community advocacy. We've done food drives. I do public speaking, any kind of advocacy work. We're developing a domestic violence program for men, as a matter of fact, right now that we hope to implement, and I'm trying to get funding for. So the best way to reach me is at our website, which just relaunched. It's Meta, Metta dash association.org. You can just Google Meta Association or Meta Association in George Brooks, and then you'll have a way to get in touch with me.
Okay, we'll make sure that information is in the show notes. So before we wrap it all up, George, one key takeaway for the audience to action.
Be patient with yourself. We're all on a journey of healing. We're all on a journey of ambition, of ascension, and discovery. So, no matter what stage of life you're going through, just be patient with yourself. It's your journey. Don't compare yourself to the person next to you. You're not them. They don't see what you see. God didn't give them what they gave you. So, stand on your own two feet, stand on your own principles, but be patient with yourself, but keep moving and keep going.
Be patient, but keep moving. Thank you, George, for showing up and being here on Survival Mode Disrupted. And listeners, thank you for catching another episode. And I just want to remind you, you were not built to break, but you damn sure were not built to just survive. Disrupt the cycle, reclaim your life, and thrive on your own terms. And I will see you next week. Once again, thank you for joining another episode of Survival Mode Disrupted, hosted by the Survival Mode Disruptor, Letitia. You didn't land here by accident. This conversation, it probably cracked something open on purpose, because survival mode isn't just a phase, it's a pattern, an identity, a prison masked as strength. But here's the truth: you're not broken. You're just unfinished. So if something stirred in you today, don't ignore it. Don't numb it. Move with it. And I want to once again invite you to join Disrupting Survival Mode, the Facebook community where healing is loud and messy and real. I also want to invite you to buy my book, the survival mode exit plan because your breakthrough deserves a blueprint. And if you felt seen today, be sure to share this episode with someone who needs to hear it. Like, subscribe, and drop a review. That's how we amplify the voices that need to be heard. And remember, this isn't about fixing yourself. This is about finding yourself again beneath the rubble. Until next time, choose ease, choose power, choose you. This is Survival Mode Disrupted. Let's keep shaking shit up.